but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, a fresh water system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
At its height, the Roman Empire encompassed one in four of the world's people. It's a period of history long mythologized for military might, engineering, systems of law and government that continue to influence us today. It's a period of legendary figures, Julius Caesar, Mark Antony, Hadrian, Augustus. And it's a period that's still being uncovered by archaeologists. Objects that shed light on how its citizens lived, paintings, sculptures, jewelry, and other beautifully preserved works of art. Well, over 250 objects dating back almost 3,000 years have come from the British Museum to Canberra for the exhibition Rome, City and Empire at the National Museum of Australia. I spoke to Torsten Opper, curator of the Rome collection at the British Museum, and Lily Withycombe, curator at the National Museum here. And I started by asking Torsten, what have the Romans ever done for us?
I think we're all Romans still, in a way. As you said in your introduction, Rome was such a mighty empire and it lasted for so long. We can all relate to it and its history. It's relevant in so many different ways and different levels as well. As you enter the exhibition, you hear this soundscape and it's Rome of the popular imagination. You hear crowd noises. It's probably set in the arena, in the Colosseum during a gladiatorial fight. That's something everybody can relate to. But then there are many pieces that were in Renaissance collections, say, that artists drew 500 years ago, 400 years ago, took inspiration from. So it works on so many different levels. It's the whole way we think about politics, the law, how societies should be organized. Most of it comes from Rome. And then because big European nations in that tradition expanded throughout the rest of the globe, it's now a shared global heritage as well.
Lily, here in Australia, how would you say we are influenced by ancient Rome?
Well, I mean, I think ancient Rome is present in our language, in our art, our architecture. I think it's actually so present in Australia, it can almost be invisible sometimes. And then when you start to deconstruct it and think about it, it's just so visible and present. But the thing that I think that Australians have been, I guess, the thing that Australia has done the most interestingly is really creatively reimagine ancient Rome. So whether it's presentations like Gladiator with, I know he's New Zealander, but let's call him Honorary Australian, with Russell Crowe and his presentation of Gladiator, to Norman Lindsay and his illustrations of Petronius's The Satyricon in the 1920s, a really famous text that was censored at the time, right up to the most recent Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras and all the depictions and costumes of ancient Rome that I saw. It really, there was a moment in the Mardi Gras this year when I felt as though I'd stumbled onto the film set of Caligula. It was really quite remarkable, the way that ancient Rome is still a touchstone for decadence and debauchery in Australia, but also for so many other things as well.
Yes. Lily, as I was reading information about the exhibition, I was so thrilled to learn about this. Is it a statue of a female gladiator?
This is an amazing object. This is definitely one of my favourite objects in the exhibition. And it's actually a large stone relief. It comes from Turkey, from a place called Bodrum. It depicts two fighting figures, and we know they're gladiators. They have the long, curved shield that gladiators used. One is in sort of a defensive pose and the other's in a more attacking pose. But what's really amazing is that above these two figures and below them is Greek script, and it actually names the two figures as Amazon and Achillea. So these two quite famous figures from Greco-Roman history or Greco-Roman mythology, but here with identified as females with this Greek ending for their names. And so it's the only known depiction of female gladiators ever found. It's really amazing.
Did female gladiators exist?
There's Roman laws that legislate against women being gladiators. So we know that they were in existence, but it was clearly something that was frowned upon. And there's also this really creepy passage in an ancient biography of the Emperor Domitian, who apparently liked to watch women fight at night by torchlight. So there clearly is an element of truth to this. There were gladiators who were women. They were called gladiatrices. But how common it was, whether it was just really a novelty or something that was quite titillating, maybe even just to the male imagination, we're not quite sure.
Torsten, why was marble so widely used? Because you're an expert in marble sculpture, aren't you?
It carves well. You can work on it easily. It was always painted. That's another thing to keep in mind. And actually, there are examples in the exhibition of pieces where you can still see pigment traces. There's a hierarchy as well. In the public sphere, honorific statues would mostly be cast of bronze, maybe gilded or silvered. In an architectural context, you then have marble statues. There's a colossal head of Faustina, the empress, the wife of the emperor Antoninus Pius, in the exhibition. And that is typical for what was produced in the cities of the Greek East, in particular in Asia Minor. There was a real marble culture in that part of the world. They had marble quarries, they had schools of sculptors that were active over centuries, hugely skilled, and they produced these wonderful pieces over many centuries.
Where was the marble from?
Often local. It seems, and marble in the past, and that's one of the misconceptions, people talk about how certain types of marble glow in the Mediterranean light. And that is true, but it is not how they appeared because, as I said, they were painted. But they have different granularity, grain sizes, the marble. So it reflects the light differently. It's can be carved differently. There's clearly a hierarchy in marbles. We have portrait statues where the body is carved of a lower grade marble, and then the portrait head itself, which was inserted separately, is of a high grade marble like Parian. Now we think that may partly to do with the way the marble takes paint and fine detail in the carving. But because there's a lot of research in recent years where they do isotope analysis and they trace marbles back to the quarries, and then you can stylistically and through sculptors' signatures, you can connect that to workshops. It's clearly that workshops were near the quarries and they specialized, and you would buy in a certain type of marble, and that came with a school of sculptors.
Dalston, do you have a particularly favorite statue that you just dream of being able to have all the time, like in your own home or something?
Oh, in my own home? Oh, gosh, I don't know. I wish my home was big enough. I keep changing my mind, but I have to say that, you know, the exhibition looks so spectacular. The lighting is just wonderful. The space is wonderful. There are a number of pieces I really like, but I also have in the back of my mind what they looked like before, how we could or could not display them. So while my favorites go in and out, there's this colossal head of the Empress Faustina I mentioned earlier, but there's also a full-length statue of a priestess that comes from a little city just in the mountains behind Pompeii, and that had a lot of work done. It now gleams almost as it was the day it was carved, fresh, sharp, really wonderful. It looks absolutely fantastic, and it's a priestess sometime during the first century. Just a wonderful piece.
And actually, if I can just jump in there, Torsten and I were walking around the exhibition just before, and his eye kept being caught by the priestess. He kept looking at it from different angles and saying, it looks amazing.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't on display at the British Museum before, was it?
We couldn't. I mean, we have all manner of issues with just the sizes of our exhibition spaces, floor loads, and so on. And I said that to friends we took around earlier. That's one of the opportunities of sharing the collection more widely and putting these shows together. We quite often get exhibition envy, should I say, where pieces great that we have in the museum just look so much more special, yeah, when they're lit properly and we have different contexts. But that means we can play with these pieces and we can, you know, we take these ideas back home, of course.
Yes, of course. Now, Torsten, when you were talking about floor loads before, do you literally mean that some of the floors of the British Museum just simply can't take the weight of these statues?
Have I let out a big secret? on the upper floors, we are somewhat limited. That's why the collection is split, and many of the sculpture galleries are down in the lower ground floor.
Yes.
On the lower ground floor. But it's that gets us into exhibition logistics. And these are lumps, tons, literally, of marble, and they're very complex to move around and display. And it certainly is a consideration for permanent galleries as well.
Yes, and how do you?
As I said, I'm a sculpture man, so I would squeeze as many marbles into an exhibition space as I possibly could.
Great. Torsten, actually, how do you move them around? I mean, something so heavy, there's an enormous statue, is this right, of a magistrate?
Yeah, which is really, really heavy. Well, we have specialist teams. We have collection managers who I've worked with these pieces for decades. When I came in to the museum 17 years ago, they were still called the old title was Mason. I thought, what are Masons? What do they do? But they were the guys who moved these heavy sculptures around. They knew them intimately. They knew exactly where to put a sling. They could guess weights and put slides under them and what. It's an absolute skill. And that is also what I love about working in the museum, that you have experts in all fields. You know, they can be scientists, curators, or just these guys who move these heavy statues. It's a skill, and you need to learn it and know how to do it.
Lily, can I ask you now about some of the frescoed wall paintings? Is it correct that they're from Emperor Nero's so-called pleasure palace nearby?
The piece is from Nero's palace. It was called the Golden Palace in antiquity because there was so much gilding, so much gold used to decorate this incredibly ornate, luxurious palace that was also located in the very centre of Rome. So at the point where the city of Rome has more than a million inhabitants and people are crowded into these busy tenements, the emperor has this huge part of the central city just for his own pleasure palace.
And it sounds a little bit like Trump Tower.
Yeah, only more spread out.
Okay.
And anyway, so there's this amazing description of his banqueting room, which had apparently ceilings and they had these special panels and they could burst open. And anyone who's in the dining room at the time would be showered with perfume or flower petals and would just have this incredibly opulent experience. And this gilded piece of wall painting, it's actually quite bright. It has two red sort of flower decorations on either end with two sphinxes as well, the mythological characters with the head of a human and the body of a lion facing each other. And also these fragments of gold decoration. It's really beautiful.
You can now, if you go to Rome, and it's actually just behind the Colosseum, you can go into the remains of Nero's Golden House, and it's really the substructures only. It caused such a scandal that he appropriated the city centre of Rome for his own country villa in the city, as it were, that it was torn down afterwards. In fact, the Colosseum was consciously built on a lake that was part of the Domus Aurea just to reclaim that for the public. Very, very cleverly done by Vespasian and his new dynasty. But so we have what used to be the lower ground floor of the Golden House left. And these are huge rooms with barrel vaults, but they're 7-8 meters high. Amazing. And the fragment Lily mentioned comes from one of these ceilings. And you wonder how on earth could anyone have gotten that out? And the fact is that these rooms were full of soil. They looked really like caves and grottos. So during the Renaissance period, people dug their way in, among them many artists, and Raphael was one of them who was heavily influenced, and they were so close to ceiling level, they could cut these things out. They were hugely inspirational. The stanza, so-called, in the Vatican by Raphael are closely based on frescoes of this type.
Lily, why do you think it is that we are still talking about Rome and are still so passionate about ancient Rome?
I think it's really important that we do look back at history and ancient history and reflect on things that were really successful and things that worked and things that touched us and still touch us, and then other things that we would never want to return to.
Oh, thank you,
Lily. I agree. I mean, I think Roman culture and history was so long and so diverse that you can identify, if you like, or feel fascinated by many different aspects. So it's not one mainstream that everybody has to relate to. If you're a young urban gay guy, you might be interested in the story of Hadrian and Antinous. If you're very conservative and militaristic, you know, the Roman army of the Republic might be the model. So there's the infinite ways of relating to that history. It's a very complex time, but the 2,000 years of what that separate us from that history, they disappear. I mean, it can become something that seems very topical and very present immediately.
Torsten Opper is the curator of the Rome Collection at the British Museum, and Lily Withercombe is a curator at the National Museum of Australia with a PhD in Roman archaeology. And you can see the exhibition Rome, City and Empire at the National Museum in Canberra until February. Now, I can't resist it. Do you remember that excellent HBO TV series Rome? Here, check out some of this.
Thank you.